We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
The New Orleans Pelicans select Zion Williamson.
And Holiday in dribble penetration. So tough going to the goal.
High up on the rim to rip it down.
Welcome to In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots Podcast. We're your hosts, Shamit Dua and Mason Ginsburg, and this is All Pelicans All the Time.
Welcome to In the Know, brought to you by no one in particular this week. So just a shout out to the network, which is the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Make sure you check out some good pods on our network. Mason, my man, how have you been? Have you been in New Orleans? Was that where you are?
Yeah, it's going on the fifth week here, but this is where this is the end. We're driving back to Chicago. This weekend, we were actually going to go leave on Friday and Saturday this past weekend, but we looked at it was literally going to be negative degrees in Chicago. And so we said, let's wait. And actually this weekend looks pretty awful across the country. Like I just saw an article that like it's supposed to get into the 20s in New Orleans, which is insane. That never happens. So I think we're picking the right time to go. If there's no real right time to leave New Orleans, but this is it.
Yeah, man, I don't know how you do it. I feel like we talk about this every third podcast. I would hate myself
in the winter
if I had to experience any of that cold. So very glad that we don't have to do that. Speaking of the cold, guess who isn't cold anymore? There's like multiple right answers for this, by the way.
I was trying to say which right answer, let's go with the obvious. No, Pelicans looking not terrible, huh?
Yeah, the Pelicans are looking not terrible. They have won 3 in a row. They are 10-12. They are basically a few games out, I think 3 or 4 games out, maybe less, from the 4th seed, right? Even though they're still only sitting the 12th seed, I believe. But you know, early season, things are looking up. And when the Pelicans are winning, we're no longer a dysfunctional organization with no direction and no hope, right? That's how it works.
Yeah, you remember last year when Scott went on and on about he wrote the Fire Gentry article and the Pelicans went on a huge run. And I feel like I wonder if you've done this, say you've created the same sort of tailwind for the Pelicans, because I feel like was it the Kings loss when things kind of came to a head for you, and then it's looked actually not terrible since?
Yeah, well, it was just like the whole, like, they subbed Zion out and then they couldn't stop anyone, and I was like, all right, this is stupid, right? They're losing the same way. These guys clearly don't care. And then they've won, you know, the next few games, which is funny to me. And there's been so they say, like, a dramatic uptick in how Zion plays defense, how Brandon Ingram plays defense, and how the team is, you know, composing themselves. Lonzo Ball is back. And so it's a long season. I get that. I don't think that the mistakes of the early season have been totally absolved. I also think that that's one of the advantages for it to being early, right? You take those losses, you take the Sacramento loss, you take that Minnesota loss, you take all those other losses that you wish you could have back. And if you don't learn from them, you are that directionless team that has a poor process. But if you learn from them, right, and you make process changes, whether that's individual players taking in that upon themselves to be better, or whether that's the coaching staff adjusting how they are using individual players. You know, Jackson Hayes is out of the rotation. Nikhil Alexander Walker did not play the other night. So, you know, these small tweaks, and you can't be like, okay, well, it's because of these small tweaks that the Pelicans are winning, right? But it's kind of one of those things where, like, inch by inch, it builds up, and you want to have steady progress going forward, and that's what you want to see. So I'm unconvinced that, you know, this is all of a sudden a great team, right? I'm unconvinced that everything is okay and the roster issues that exist suddenly don't exist. But I tweeted before that Kings game at some point, like, you know, it'll get better, right? They played a ridiculously hard road game, road schedule, and which was just brutal, absolutely brutal. And the schedule is going to get lighter, especially in the back half, because, you know, the NBA has been front loading the national TV games for the Pelicans just so they can see where they will be in the second half of the season. And a lot of those national TV games are against really good teams. And so, yeah, the Pelicans, I would say the Pelicans are not too far off from where they were projected to be record-wise and, you know, standing-wise if everything had gone to plan.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think this team, they're making steps. And I said something about it this weekend about, I think as we move further and further away from that awful 2-week road trip, we're going to realize how actually difficult it was. Like, I feel like it was, it could have been even harder if they started off with that. Although actually Dallas hasn't played that well. So maybe that first game against Dallas, we're missing because we would have caught them at a good time when they're really not playing that well. And cause I would think I'm assuming they're going to get better as the season goes on, cause they're not that good of a team right now. And maybe we missed a good shot against them. But I mean, other than that, a bunch of tough games. The Kings, I feel like, is a lot of De'Aaron Fox just won player of the week. I mean, that team's playing very well. And so that was one of the Pelicans' road wins. Obviously, they lost to at home and kind of frustrated a lot of people. But that team's playing pretty well overall. And then the last game of the road trip, obviously, is the one people got most upset about against Minnesota. Like, that's a game you have to win when you're and the team was pretty much fully healthy, and you've got to win that game. I mean, I'm not here to make excuses for that loss, to say that they shouldn't have won, but I will say that playing at the end of a 2-week road trip when you're pretty much locked into your hotel room more or less, and it's not the same type of, yeah, you can't, I'll be PG here, but you probably feel like you're in solitary confinement or close to it. And I know that's an exaggeration, but I mean, like, compared to what the normal lifestyle is on the road for an NBA player, I mean, you're probably over it at the end of a 2-week trip that's that long. So, I don't entirely think that they were playing in optimal circumstances there. So, like, I mean, besides the road trip, which is six games, so that's not nothing, this team's playing all right. I mean, they won a close game against the Pacers, which I think is big because last year we all know how bad they were in crunch time. And this year it's kind of been fairly hit or miss as well. They won a couple games convincingly over the Suns and the Bucks, which is, I mean, the Bucks made a nice comeback, but I think most of the game, the Pelicans had it in hand, which was impressive. So, I mean, there's some things to like here. I think we'll talk about some of the specifics as we get into more details, but in this podcast, but you know, trending up overall.
Yeah. So like, you know, each player has their own way of stress management and stress release and things to lighten the load when the going gets tough. And especially for people like JJ, who are, you know, very devoted to their family, and, you know, his family's in Brooklyn right now, right? He hasn't seen them for months in that road trip. He can't even do anything with his teammates. They're just kind of locked in there, not allowed to do anything. And the kind of tracks with his trade scenario where the Pelicans are looking to perhaps send him to a Northeastern team. And I think that that's good. I'm not too convinced that the Pelicans are actually going to be able to get anything worthwhile for JJ. I think that that could be an issue where we're just looking at a situation where we have to buy him out. And it will be disappointing if that is the end of the JJ Redick era. Is, you know, you got a year and a half out of him. The results weren't fantastic in terms of a win-loss outcome. And then hopefully, you know, his leadership has rubbed off on some of the young players. You just, that's something unquantifiable for us outsiders. But if it results in a buyout, you know, I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed in that situation. But who knows? You know, there is no more urgency to kind of flip him. They very clearly sat him right around that reaggregation deadline date, right? And so the reaggregation deadline, the way it works is if you trade JJ and the player you're getting back, if you want to trade them in combination with another player before the deadline. So like, let's say you traded JJ for, I don't know, I'm just going to make up a name here. But you know, I think Mike Scott is the one that's on the Sixers, right? So let's say it was like Mike Scott and some salary. Let's say you made that trade and then you want to trade Bledsoe plus Mike Scott for something else at the deadline. If you want to be able to combine those two players together, you have to do it by that date. You know, any player that you're making a trade for now, you're not going to be able to combine them with any other Pelicans player at the deadline. And so, you know, now that that deadline is gone, I don't see any key advantage of them rushing to a trade. I also don't see any key advantage for, if I'm an opposing team, to really entertain the Pelicans on a trade, call their bluff, right? Make them buy him out. But we'll see. You know, JJ isn't expiring, and maybe there is a team that wants to shed salary, future salary, that the Pelicans can utilize JJ's contract in.
Yeah, and I think even for the Pelicans, I mean, the one downside of not moving him beyond the asset accumulation is that, you know, there's been a lot of talk about freeing up minutes for the Pelicans' younger guards. And so I think now, especially that team's playing better of late, and JJ's been a part of that, even though he isn't, you know, he hasn't, his shooting woes aren't suddenly gone. But I think you're seeing the value he can provide. I feel like the lineup specifically, it hasn't been much, but when he's been playing with the starters, whether it's minus Bledsoe or minus Lonzo, it doesn't really matter. I feel like, especially given the way that they're playing now and the way that they're utilizing Zion, I think his value increases on the offensive end. Obviously, defense is another story, but yeah, I like how he still makes sense for this team. And so he should get minutes in my opinion. And but that said, if they find a trade that makes sense for them and can get, you know, get some assets and then get more minutes for the young guys, I'm all aboard that as well.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think we've talked about endlessly how the biggest assets you're going to get from a lot of these trades is just those minutes for the young guys, minutes for Kyra. And so, yeah, I'm doubtful that the Pelicans will get anything worthwhile for JJ if they can move him and all they're getting is room under the tax line. That is a fantastic asset. in my book, because I just, man, those bench units are rough. You know, you talked about the starter units. Yeah, okay. But those bench units are a disaster. The J.J. Hart duo is a disaster. You know, and then you're adding in Jackson Hayes, who has been terrible. And Zion's tasked to lead those bench units. And, you know, there is a lot of praise for Willie, but I think it's coming from the fact that he's not Jackson. And I think people need to be cognizant of the fact that he's also not good. And that's not a solution for the Pelicans' bench woes. And yeah, man, I think there is a massive addition by subtraction potential for moving JJ at this point in time for the Pelicans. I just think that's a minute sink. That's a defensive sink. That's a kind of messes up your offensive flow, because he's not a guy that you just plant in the corner. He's a move off screens, run dribble handoffs ad nauseum type of player where you have to, like, you know, actually utilize him in that way. And man, like, I'm just out on those bench units. I'm just completely out. I'm tired of watching them. They're terrible.
What I feel like you mentioned certain players, but the bench units, I mean, like, is the fix getting new players? And it seems like that's the easiest fix, but what do you feel like is the hardest part to really, what can be fixed without moving players, in your opinion? Can anything?
Bench JJ, man, just don't fucking play him.
Huh?
Sorry. That's really rough. I think there is huge addition by subtraction. We've seen it with Jackson, right? You want to raise the floor of those bench units. Jackson was a sink. You know, he was just dragging those things down for a variety of reasons. You know, I've talked about how that lineup isn't suited for him, or, you know, it's not optimizing him as well because of the Pelicans four guard play, but he's not doing himself any favors either. So, you know, they removed him. There's a little bit of higher floor with Willie. You're not going to have that same upside, but you're not going to be like, oh my God, what is this guy doing for, you know, 8 minutes straight. With JJ, I think it's the same thing. You know, if he's not hitting his shots, which has been the majority of nights, he is a total negative. He doesn't give you defense. He doesn't give you rebounding. He doesn't give you anything on the court, anything at all. And so, you know, with the Pelicans, just like, okay, well, what is the answer there? And it's a tough one because Nikhil has been terrible. Nikhil has just been abjectly terrible. But here's what I think Nikhil gives you. I think Nikhil, if his shots aren't hitting, he will give you a higher defensive floor. And he will give you playmaking, and he will give you, you know, this ability to get in the paint a little bit. He's at least a little bit of an event generator, right? Where he leads the team in deflections, even when it's limited minutes. He has one of the highest deflection rates in the league per 36 minutes. I think it may be one. You know, he generates turnovers. He generates events. You know, he rebounds the ball. He can do things with the ball in his hand. And so if you're going with, so if my option is, play a guy whose only value is hitting shots and he's not hitting them, or play a guy who's a guy that's also not hitting shots, but, you know, he can at least give you other things on the basketball floor, you know, ride with that young fella. Ride with that young fella and pray to God that there's some consistency that comes out of him getting consistent minutes. And yeah, that is where I'm at.
Interesting. I don't agree. I think if the goal is to play the young guys, I think the difference between JJ and Nikhil, the way they're both playing right now, isn't wide enough to tell me not to play Nikhil. So I hear you there, but I feel like it's too much for me. Just I'm overweighting, I think, the start to JJ's season here when the guy can shoot the ball. You don't lose. Like, there's a lot of things you can lose over almost overnight when it comes to, you know, being on the back end of your career and being a little older. I can't buy that shooting has just disappeared from JJ's arsenal. And I really do feel like, even if he's not hitting, I mean, we spent a lot of time over the last few podcasts talking about spacing and what you need to be a true spacer. And JJ has those things, even though he's not hitting right now, that the guy's made a career out of just knocking down crazy difficult 3-point shots. And I think he still gives you that element of spacing. And so I think he still has an impact on your offense, even if he's not knocking down shots. And so, I mean, I'll be the first to say the defense is a problem, but if we're trying to win games don't really care over the next few games about development, I still think I prefer JJ, but I totally, if they want to go with Nikhil because, you know, get more minutes for that young guy, then I'm all about it too. I just don't know if it's.
Yeah. JJ can have a night where he's like 4 of 6 from three, and you're not going to convince me at this point that he was as big of a positive as him hitting those shots was. Like, you know, even on the nights where he hits shots, I still think that he's liable to be a massive negative on the floor. And that's where I'm at with JJ, is that even when you do hit shots, how, like, is it a net positive? Is it bringing your balance back into the green? I don't see it with him. And I think there are teams that could bring that out of him, and teams that can optimize units that'll bring that out of him, but not for what the Pelicans need. And not for where they are. And I just think at this point in his career on this team and the way it's constructed, he's a negative no matter what he's doing.
Fair enough.
I just feel like you'd have to go on like a real heater, you know, for like 6 or 7 games straight. And we're like, okay, yeah, this guy is just completely changing that dynamic of the offense. Mm. Whereas like, I don't know. I'm out on JJ. Sorry, JJ, you're a great person. I'm out.
If you assume that raises the floor of the bench, I'm surprised we haven't hit on another guy who's been playing a little bit more recently and playing well. Are you going there next?
That's any number of people, man. Bledsoe's been playing well. Hart's been playing well.
Oh, come Lonzo's on. I'm
been
talking...
playing well.
I'm talking about
Zion's playing well.
Kyra, man.
Oh, yeah, dude. I mean, look, I could talk about Kyra for the next 35 minutes straight without letting you speak at all. And I'm not sure. I mean, maybe that is what the people want.
I'm
right?
happy what the people want, man.
that is what the people want.
But I mean, you're talking about what would raise the floor of the bench. And I feel like what we've seen in limited minutes from Kyra has been a lot of good. And so you let that dude play, right?
Yes, 100%. And yes, I am 100% okay with him playing Nikhil off the floor, right? Nikhil, if it's his minutes that are gone at the expense of Kyra's, wonderful. I mean, I'd prefer him to be JJ's, right? But I don't care. As long as Kyra is getting minutes, that is a win in my book. Excuse me. That's a win in my book. And it's just evident from, you know, you even hear the Pelicans announcers, Joel Myers and Antonio Daniels. Like, I don't know if it's subtle. I don't know if it's intentional, but like when Kyra threw the lob to Zion, it was Joel's call was like, and what a read from a natural lead guard. You know, and then there's always emphasis. There's always emphasis on Kyra's ability to get in the paint and create for others and draw the defense. And yes, I mean, you know, those things are what we have been asking for from Pelicans guards for a very long time. And Kyra, you know, this, I don't think it's a hot take anymore. I think Kyra may legitimately be the Pelicans' best guard at drawing in the defense and reading and reacting and creating open shots for others. I legitimately think Kyra may be the best guard on the roster at that skill. Does that make him the best guard overall? No, you know, there's a lot more to the basketball game than driving and kicking and making reads. But I think at that particular skill, he might be the best. And I think, you know, with his skill in the pick and roll and as a driver, you know, that's the type of guard a guy like Jackson Hayes needs to look good. And when you go back and watch Jackson Hayes film and highlights from the previous year, why did he look so good? Well, they ran spread pick and rolls for him
and he received dunks and lobs because people would key in on the guards and he would just be having a wide open run to the rim. And that spread pick and roll game has just completely disappeared when he's on the floor. And then also he's spent pretty much all of his minutes with Zion. And when Zion's on the floor, like, sorry, Jackson Hayes, you're just not going to be an offensive focus, dude. Like, just go stand there in the dunker spot. And so, but yeah, if Kyra is on the floor, and even if Jackson Hayes isn't on the floor, right, with Zion himself, like in those bench units, that's a combination I want to see much, much more of going forward.
Yeah. I mean, I absolutely agree. I think we've been talking a lot about obviously shooting has been a problem for the team this year, last few games notwithstanding. But I think we've both been adamant that the biggest problem here is creation and attacking and finding guards that can, you know, put pressure on the defense. Because when that's really just Brandon Ingram and a little bit of Bledsoe, you've got some problems, because you could have all the shooters you want, but if no one really cares about protecting the paint because no one's going to make that, you know, make you do it, then your defenders are going to stay attached to those guys that are on the perimeter. And so, so to see Kyra come in and instantly be able to get there, obviously the shot's not falling yet. I mean, he's not Ja Morant right now. So like, I mean,
he's taking like one shot, like one three per game, you know, like two layups per game. And I am a full believer in his shooting ability. Like, yeah. I think when he gets up to 10 shots per game, you're going to see like a marked difference on like what he's producing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, even like, so he's in his last six games, he's 2 of 5 from beyond the arc. So like you're, I mean, it's not like he's going to take more of them, I think, as he continues in his career. So for sure. So I think that's, you know, we got a lot of guys like Bledsoe's a good example. Nikhil's a good example, guys who can get into the paint pretty nicely, but aren't always the best at creating for others. I think we've seen Bledsoe for, I mean, he's ticked up in 3-point shooting this year. He's doing great, but he's also taken a lot of difficult shots in the restricted area this year. And so, you know, part of that is the Pelicans don't really have great spacing. So the defense kind of collapses around him. Part of it is just because he's not as good as Drew was at creating for others, but Kyra is the guy who can do that. The question is, you know, what's the learning curve for him? If he plays significant minutes, there's going to be bumps, right? He's not going to just instantly become this awesome creator and never turn the ball over, even though he's been great about taking care of the ball so far. But I want to see more. I think everyone wants to see more of it. And hopefully he's going to earn Stan Van Gundy's trust sooner rather than later.
Yeah. It seems like they're all itching to play him. And, you know, the scene, the impression I get behind the scenes is he's been absolutely killer in practice. Like they just gush about Kyra and they think that he can impact winning today. And, you know, he's like, okay, well, why don't you play him? Well, it's not that easy. It's not that easy to be like, okay, we're benching you, Lonzo. We're benching you, Bledsoe. We're benching you, JJ. You can't, you know, it's hard. And so that's why those trades are necessary. That's why those moves are necessary to get Kyra those minutes. That being said, you know, I like this conversation about being able to put pressure on the defense and create shots, because we have seen a lot more point Zion. Zion has been given the freedom to go initiate the offense, to start games off initiating the offense. And it has, I think it has many, many benefits, both in the short term and the long term. But curious to get your thoughts on that development.
Yeah, it's been fun. I think as fun as seeing him be that guy. And I love hearing Griff talk about him and Stan too, but about how he was a point guard growing up and he likes to create for others. That's where he, you know, he feels most comfortable, or really, you know, he feels like he thrives the most. And so I think you're seeing that. I mean, you were talking about the change in the overall offensive, you know, productivity of the Pelicans over the last few games. I was kind of looking at what has happened off of those Zion passes over the last six games. Cause I mean, that's been the difference maker for the Pelicans, has been his ability to create for others. I mean, there's been, I was looking at like some of Zion's stats over the last few games and like what's correlated the most with success. And it's not things like his usage rate. I think it's more, and I was looking at that because his highest usage rate games are Pelicans losses. But I think that's a little bit about what his role was earlier on the season. And now what is it becoming now? And I think it's truly he's morphing into more of a distributor for others, as well as a guy who's going to go and get his own shots, obviously. But the 3-point shots he's been creating for his teammates has been incredible. I mean, I think it was 55% or so is what the Pelicans are shooting from three on his passes over the past 6 games, which is nuts for this team, right? They've been terrible at shooting threes all season. Bledsoe's like 55%, Lonzo's 60%, B.I. and J.J. are like 50% or better. I mean, the only guy who's shooting a bad percentage is Nikhil. He's 0-3. I mean, everyone else has been making and taking 3-pointers based off of clear looks that Zion has given them. And so let's just, again, kind of like Kyra, let's keep seeing it. Defenses are going to adjust. This is kind of a new thing that they're seeing out of Zion. How do you defend him? There's no easy answer, but I think you'll see him start to have to work a little bit harder to do things like that. But I mean, for now it's taking opponents. They're having a hell of a time stopping him.
Yeah. And it's funny because I was looking into his passes as well, because I was looking into who passes the ball to him and what's the result of that. Right. I tweeted about it the other day and it was hard not to look at the results of his passing as well. Like, you know, and for the season, Bledsoe and Lonzo are both a combined like 40% from three off of his passes. Now, you know, I'm going to go ahead and say that that tracking data isn't necessarily the most accurate and it's not logged the most accurately. And we do deal with a lot of small sample size issues. And so we have to be careful on how to draw conclusion from that. Like you said, like 55% from three is fantastic. I mean, they're getting really good looks, but are they a 55% from three type of team? Or do they have those quality of shooters? Absolutely not. And so some of it's just luck, right? Those shots are going down and Zion was creating looks earlier in the season that weren't going down. But I do like the added emphasis because like Giannis, like Ben Simmons, you know, he has a gifted amount of physical abilities that allow him to put a lot of pressure at the rim that just draws all the defenses and it creates easy looks. An NBA player should be able to hit easy looks at a good offensive clip, right? You know, above 35% from three rate, which is going to turn into a good offense, right? An efficient offense. And so maybe not 55%, but you get him around that 37% mark. That's fantastic. You know, that's a good offensive possession and you want that. So I'm happy with that. The other reason I'm happy is that it's gone away from the whole Brandon Ingram centric initiate the offense, where I feel like that took a lot of mental bandwidth for BI and a lot of physical bandwidth for BI to do that over the course of a game. And that's why you saw not enough effort on the defensive end. And that's why you've seen poor outings from Brandon Ingram in the fourth quarter or in the second half. And frankly, I'm not going to attribute all of Ingram's shortcomings to this shift, but it does allow him that bandwidth to play harder on the other end. And it does save his legs. It saves his capacity to make more of an impact in the fourth quarter. So I hope to continue to see that. So that's important. Secondly, and I think this is perhaps the biggest win, right? You don't go through those 6-minute stretches where Zion just does not touch the ball. Those like infuriating 6-minute stretches where Brandon doesn't find him, or Lonzo doesn't find him, or Bledsoe doesn't find him, or whoever, you know, where he just doesn't touch the ball. And that's what's maddening to me. And this is a simple way around that. And they can get really creative with their offensive sets from this configuration.
Yeah, look, and eventually you got to just take a look in the mirror and look at, and to tie it back to what we were saying about Kyra, this team doesn't have enough creators to not give Zion those chances. I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, they put so much of this load on BI in the fourth quarter because he's the best guy at it. And he's most of the, I guess, triple threat that you could have out there, but it takes such a toll on him on both ends of the floor, and it becomes predictable at some point and easier to stop. I mean, anyone in isolation in the half court, even the best isolation players, it's not an efficient offense in the grand scheme of things. I guess maybe James Harden off to the side and in that, but it's just not. You need to have a more dynamic offense, and I think this does get open up another option for them. And so it's, you know, yeah, I mean, do it not only because Zion's proving to be really good at it, but do it because you have a lot of other great options. And as far as, you know, shot creators, both for yourself and for others. And so, you know, it just makes too much sense.
That's absolutely true. And so good for Zion. And you know what? There was a lot of conversation about Lonzo Ball unlocking Zion Williamson, and maybe it turns out it's Zion Williamson that unlocks Lonzo Ball, who is on an absolute heater. Yeah. You know, ever since he returned back from injury, he's up to nearly 37% from three over the course of his season. You know, he's been shooting around 55% from three over his last three or four games. He came up huge in that Indiana game, right? And he was a total non-factor for basically three quarters. And then that fourth quarter, shot after shot after shot, and that clutch stop. So I am taking Lonzo Ball stock to the moon and to the trade deadline. Because you are not going to find a bigger fan than me until March 25th. Because let me tell you, Lonzo Ball on the best stat in the world, RPM, ESPN's RPM, the most infallible stat. Everyone says it's the best thing ever. Please don't quote me on that. He's like 13th overall. It means he's the 13th best player in the league. He's better than Jason Tatum. I believe it. It is true. He is one of the best 3-and-D players in the league. You know, he's shooting above average from three-point range. He's locking down people, making good rotations. This is Lonzo Ball, baby. And if you are a GM listening to this podcast and you want Lonzo Ball, well, you cannot have him unless you pay a significant price. Oh, I'm talking multiple picks. I'm talking throwing a pick with Lauri Markkanen, throwing a pick with Kevin Huerter. Just can't have him. He's too valuable to this team. Do you agree, Mason?
The player you just described, I want multiple picks. One's not enough. Let's give him some credit here, because he has been legitimately good over the last few games. It's been, I think the point about Zion unlocking Lonzo is kind of, again, it's kind of tongue in cheek because of what people said about the opposite, to your point, but it's been really fun to watch. He's engaged, active defensively. Like, to his credit, he's been all season. He's been a strong defender all season. He's doing a little bit more. I feel like his offense kind of drives his defense sometimes, which, and he's making shots. I mean, he's the same. The thing is, he's still the same player he has been. Like, his game hasn't changed. His stylistically has not become different. I'd say the only thing that I think Lonzo's done differently this year is he's defending more consistently. That's absolutely true. And he's having a very strong defensive season.
You mean it's easier to defend more consistently when your offensive load in terms of initiating offense is lower?
And when you're not,
I am surprised.
And when you're not missing shots and defending in transition too, right? Yeah. So, you know, it comes down to the same age old question we've had for a year and a half with him now. It's consistency. It's, you know, he's not suddenly a magnificently different player than he was three or four games ago. He's just making threes now. The one thing I get kind of frustrated with is there's always an excuse about. You know, how he started last year was coming up, you know, he didn't have a training camp to get healthy. This year it was like, oh, but his knee was hurting. And so that's why he's shooting better now. And these are things I've actually, you know, I've gotten multiple times from people. I don't know what the excuse was for the bubble, but it's just like, they only go so far because you need consistency from him. You can't pay that player big money who's going to be a non-factor for three or four games and then show up for three or four games. Like, that's, you need some sort of consistency. And so, I'm kind of like you said about things you said about JJ. Like, I'm not, maybe you disagree with this, but I'm not just jettisoning Lonzo for anything just to get the young guys more minutes. I mean, I think I'm very happy to continue to watch him play if he's playing at this level. until they get an offer that they think is worth moving him. So my overall opinion hasn't changed about, you know, his fit on this team long term, but there's no denying he's playing better right now. He is. And I've enjoyed watching him play the last few games. That stop on Miles Turner was incredible. And like I said it on Twitter, the Pelicans do not win that Pacers game without that performance from him. Full stop.
Yeah. And so, I mean, look, the Pelicans don't win a lot of games without his performance. And that is exactly the issue. The issue is in wins, he's averaging about 17 points a game on like shooting 45% from three. And in losses, he's averaging about 10 points a game with, you know, shooting like 12% from three and not contributing in any meaningful way on the offense. And so the Pelicans have more losses than wins. What does that tell you?
Yeah.
Right. And so I feel like I'm destined to be trapped in this loop forever until this player is either extended or he's traded. Whatever the case is, I'm going to be trapped in this loop forever where it's, oh, he's playing poorly. You're right. Trade him. Or hold on to him, actually, until we can rebuild his value a little bit because no one wants him. He had a terrible bubble performance. He started off really poorly. No one wants him. Hold on to him. His value is going to get higher. and then he starts playing well. He strings together three good games in a row. And then all of a sudden, it's like, oh, man, I don't know. I don't know if we should trade him. If he's playing like this, but winning, why would you ever move him? And it's like, you guys – you got to pick a stance, right? You got to pick a stance, and then you got to find arguments that move you from the stance. If your stance isn't pinned down anywhere, you're always going to be a prisoner of the moment. Yep. My stance at the beginning of the season, before the season started, was you trade him. Has he done enough for me this season to move me off that stance? Absolutely not.
No.
Absolutely not.
It's not close.
Am I happy with how he's playing? Sure. But that's the issue. You know, 11 months ago, 12 months ago, we said this. We said this is the issue with Lonzo Ball. He gives you those glimpses. He gives you those flashes to where you're left guessing, man, what if? What? Imagine what this can be. And then it goes right back in the gutter where he has those games where he's 1-for-7. And you're like, dude, what are you doing? And you can't pay a guy $20+ million who you don't know what you're getting in, night out. You just can't do it. And frankly, again, if he is able to move me off my stance, great. March 25th isn't that far ahead in the future. I very much doubt he's going to move me off my stance. He could be hot for the next 2 months, right, until the deadline, and my stance is still going to be you move him until I see a meaningful change in his game.
And now, again, it's about style and what he does, not just how he does it, right? That's the thing is when the shot is not falling, what does he do for you on offense? And the answer is not a whole lot. And so until that changes, or he's a consistent three-point threat to the degree that defenses give a shit about when he squares up to shoot, which, to your point, I do not think a month and a half of data is enough to move either of us off of that stance.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, yeah, he had a month and a half where he got hot last year,
yep,
around this time.
But the bubble, right? Man, it messed up his rhythm.
No, but that's exactly the thing. It's like, okay, well, he was hot for a month and a half, which is great.
Yep.
But what about the prior month and a half? What about the subsequent month and a half? Right. And so if he gets hot for a month and a half now, great. What about the first 20 games of this season? You just throw that away?
Yeah.
And I just, you know, like, it's when you're so much of your offensive utility is predicated upon you being able to knock down threes, and this applies to even one of the best shooters in history in JJ Redick, you better be damn good at that job and be consistent at it for you to regularly provide positive value. Mm-hmm. JJ, you know, up until this year was. Yep. This year, you're seeing, you know, his variance have a pretty high uptick, and it's destroying the Pelicans because they don't know what they're getting out of him.
It's destroying him. And that's Lonzo Ball, whether people like it or not, he's a 3-and-D player at this stage. Yep. And if that three component isn't there night in, night out, it's rough. It is rough, especially, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that you make the Lonzo Ball decision based off of who is currently in your backcourt, because, you know, Bledsoe is not a long-term partner. Yeah, but you just need some consistency in the backcourt from both those guys, because Bledsoe's the same way this year. His stats are the exact same in wins. You know, he's like 17, 18 points per game, like 45% from three, and losses, it's like 10 points a game. And you're like, dude, what are you giving me, man? Like, yeah. What's going on? Because, and I feel like it's worse in the case of Bledsoe, because he's a vet and he's letting, and maybe it's, you know, it's a situation where like, he's not on a contender anymore. Right. And the game is, yeah. And the game is a little bit more difficult because he doesn't have that level of talent around him as well. And who knows, you know, maybe with Zion playing in a Giannis like fashion will lead to a better Bledsoe, because that's what he's used to for the last few years. But, you know, with Bledsoe, it's like, okay, well, you're an NBA vet. You can't have nights where you let your offense dictate what you're giving us on the other end.
Especially because, like, if you had told me that Eric Bledsoe would be shooting 40% this year on threes with over 100 attempts so far, I would have been like, oh, hell yeah, that's awesome. And, like, that's just not the – I mean, that it is great. It's been helpful for the Pelicans, who otherwise have had a very inconsistent and poor shooting season. Bledsoe, I feel like, has been the one – beyond maybe like BI, it's been the one consistent threat from deep for the Pelicans this year, which is really weird. But the other stuff is definitely inconsistent. So like, it's not like Lonzo's the only guy who's the culprit here. It's also Eric Bledsoe.
Yeah, and it's also JJ Redick. It's also Josh Hart. It's been the entire Pelicans perimeter outside of Brandon Ingram. It's also Nikhil Alexander-Walker, who's just been absolutely terrible from three. You know, it's having four or five or six high variance 3-point players whose entire game, it's like, okay, if they're not hitting 3-point shots, like, what are they giving you? That's what's maddening, right? You know, with BI, if he's not hitting from three, he's getting to the free throw line, he's getting to the paint, he's getting to the rim, right? And you know, yes, there's been like one or two games where that's been difficult for him, or he just, you know, wasn't able to get it going. That's fine, right? It's like one or two in the grand scheme of things. But you know what you're getting out of him every night, even if he's missing threes. With Zion, you know, threes aren't even a factor. He's going to do whatever he wants. Good luck stopping that. You know, and Adams isn't there for offense. He's there for all the other things, right? But if your entire offensive play and your entire perimeter play from the 1 through 3 positions, it's like, okay, if these guys' shots aren't falling, they're not giving you anything, you're going to be a bad offensive team. And I know the Pelicans are 12th best in, you know, 12th in offense right now, which is great. And I think, you know, part of that is with Zion and Brandon being absolutely ridiculous for the last couple of weeks or so. And it's nice that Lonzo's hitting his shots and Bledsoe's hitting his shots. But I don't think that's a real number in the sense that you bring it to crunch time, the Pelicans are going to be a really efficient offensive team. They're not. They're still among the league's worst. Even over the period of this past week, we saw them just absolutely melt away against the Pacers bench unit. You know, we saw them melt away against Milwaukee. Well, they're a good team. And, you know, we saw they punched back when the Grizzlies broke through and almost tied up the game. And that was good. That was progress. But on the balance, you know, you take this the way it's constructed and you bring that into a playoff setting where all of a sudden those open catch and shoot threes aren't so open anymore. Jeez, man, it gets ugly. It gets ugly. And that's, you know, I there is a lot of talent overhaul that needs to happen. And it doesn't need to happen like, you know, today, tomorrow, by the deadline. Just when I talk about this, I'm thinking in the future, in the sense that, you know, if your aspirations are a deep playoff team or a contender level team, well, you know, that stuff can't be around.
Yeah. And like, I'll just say it on top of that, if that was where the Pelicans thought they would be sooner rather than later, I don't really think that they're going to get Steven Adams, just, you know, to put it bluntly. I mean, that I think Steven Adams is a means to an end as far as getting the Pelicans to another level that they're not playing at today, and in different aspects, not just like whatever the what the offensive efficiency is, right? And so that's going to be a process to get to that type of deep playoff type level of scoring ability and crunch time legitimacy. Yeah, it's certainly a work in progress, and you need to have dynamic players on offense that you know, you can have a player or two that as his 3-point shooting goes, as he goes, but those have to be more specialist type roles. Those can't be,
that's gotta be like your the offense. Fifth best player on your squad, right? Yeah. You know, that can't be your third offensive option, mm-hmm. and also your fourth and your fifth and your sixth and your seventh. Yeah. You know, like guys 3 through 7 can't be that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, one last thing to hit on with this, with Lonzo. And I think, so we got, by the way, I tweeted out like asking for questions literally right before we started recording. And I think we got a lot of good ones that maybe we can hit on at another, maybe we recorded another one in a day or two and touch on it. But I think it's important to bring up, there's been a couple of questions around sell high on Lonzo right now. It's like, I can't impress enough, despite the, you know, sarcastic comments you and I have made. That's not how NBA front offices think. People will get fired if they thought about that and said, oh, well, look, Lonzo's made a lot of threes the last 3 or 4 games. His value's peaked. It's like, that's no decision-making process is going to take that route. I mean, you've got to have consistency.
Man, I'm very glad you mentioned that. Yeah, like, you know, yeah. You and I meme about it, right?
Yes.
Like, sell. Yeah, no, that no front office operates like that.
Yeah.
I mean, well,
good qualifier. Fair enough. You find the one team that does, and go for it.
There was a team that paid Solomon Hill $48 million off of a 2-week we'll talk playoff about run. That. Yeah, no, but in seriousness, like, most teams just do not operate this way.
Yeah. So hey, if Griff can find the one team that doesn't, and say, hey, look at the last couple of weeks, this is who he is, can go for it. But you know, whether it's Lonzo or anyone else, I mean, it doesn't, that's not how this works. That's not how any of this works.
99.9% of like trades, they happen within those 24 hours of that trade deadline. And that's for many reasons. One, NBA executives are habitual procrastinators. Two, it's always, you know, these guys are like, okay, well, we want to have the least amount of opportunity cost possible.
Sunk cost fallacy too, huh?
Right. Well, sunk cost fallacy is part of it, but it's this idea of like, we just don't know what the landscape of all of our options is going to be until that hard deadline. And so, you know, it's one of those things like, okay, well, if I make the move now, damn, like, could I have gotten, you know, could you know, in the next month, like someone have, you know, some team have an injury issue and they have a desperate need to fill this gap or et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, they try to make the decision with the most amount of information as possible. And to them, that happens as you approach the deadline. And so I would be very shocked if there is any movement on the trade front with the Pelicans in before the deadline. But I would also be very shocked if they did absolutely nothing at all by the time the deadline is passed.
Yep. Absolutely. I mean, like we've been saying it, on multiple podcasts. I mean, at minimum, one of those guards among Bledsoe, Lonzo, and JJ is out before the deadline. I think most likely, whether it's trade or buyout, hopefully trade, it's probably two of them. I think that's, if you had to bet, if you had, how many of those three guards are with the team after the deadline, would your most likely answer be one, or would it be two?
It'd be one or zero.
Ooh, that's hot. That's a hot take.
It'd be one or zero.
Yeah. So I'm squarely at one, but I think two is more likely than zero. So that's interesting.
Yeah. Okay. I think zero is more likely than two. And again, people are going to call me crazy, but one of the reasons they're going to wait till the deadline is they'll have a better picture on what the hell's going on with Bradley Beal.
There it is.
It is. It's true. No,
it's fair. It's fair.
True.
Yeah.
You guys think I'm crazy?
It no, it's fair. It's all, I mean, what type of assets you got for me, right? And the Pelicans have a unique treasure chest of assets that are, may not be better in some cases than other teams' offers, but are different. And different is important in this case. And so,
look, man, we got the 13th best player according to Real Plus Minus, ESPN.com, greatest stat of all time. You know what's funny? In a serious note, you know, I'm in like the nerd Slack that's full of like the Twitter nerds who are NBA analytics like fans. That includes a lot of people who are. Who helped, you know, some people that designed that stat originally, as well as, you know, people that have formerly worked in NBA front offices in analytics capacity and whatnot. It's a really fun Slack. I'm not just trying to flex on people like, oh, look, I know these people. But those smart, really intelligent people basically were like, yeah, all the people that originally worked on RPM when it first came out are like no longer on the project, and they've like completely bastardized it. In its new formation to where its reliability is like none, especially this early on in the season. And it's one of the issues with RPM is that it's a black box. They're not really telling you what kind of inputs, statistical inputs that they're taking. You know, at one point they were taking stuff like height. Apparently now they're taking stuff like tracking data. I think Kevin Pelton had an article where he was talking about Lonzo Ball's like head-to-head passes, you know, being incorporated in that. You know, it's, again, you take it with a grain of salt. There are better all-in-one stats out there, but for our agenda, there are no better stats out there. This is the best one, and yes, we expect Starlight compensation if you even want him.
The pass ahead stuff. I had to read it a second time. Like, I get there. There's plenty I don't know about that type of. Those types of advanced analytics and how to generate the best possible predictive metrics. But that just doesn't seem like the right answer. It's like almost, it feels like you're trying too hard to be different, and that's what you came up with.
Well, my issue with like kind of these predictive metrics as a whole is like, I kind of wish that there was more creativity in the public sphere. There's a lot of very intelligent people doing a lot of very fun things. And so this is not a knock on the analytics communities, because like I respect a lot of those people and consider some of them my friends. But I wish there was more creativity in the sense that oftentimes it feels like we're in a rush to create the best all-in-one stat, and they all end up being like 1 or 2% better than the other, you know? And they're 1 or 2% better than the other. And honestly, you know, their best use is like beating Vegas over under. So if you're a gambling degenerate, those things are your best friend, and every edge that you can get is amazing. But you know, that's just like my small nitpicking quibble with the way that the people in the analytics community kind of approach what they're trying to accomplish. But you know, there's a lot of great work out there, and I don't want to throw that under the bus.
Yeah, for sure. Anything else to hit on? I feel like we've done a nice job of capturing kind of what's going on with the team recently. We missing anything?
Oh yeah. Just closing thoughts. You know, what the defensive buy-in from Zion and Brandon Ingram.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Let's go.
What are your thoughts? What do you make of that? Is it sustainable to you? Is it a progress, or is it just like, hey, they tried hard for 3 games?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always, you got to prove it to me with that kind of stuff. I mean, I think we saw as the classic example of this to me was Julius Randle when he was in New Orleans. I mean, and actually like a few years in his career, like he was, you saw it for the first quarter of the season or first 20% of the season, and then it just fell off. And so, I mean, you start to pick your spots as the season goes on and where you want to put that effort into. And with players like Zion, like BI, I could easily see them start to put more of that effort and intensity on the offensive end and let it go on defense. So, I mean, I think everything you said earlier in the podcast about Zion taking some of the offensive load late in games off of BI, allowing them both to really have more energy to exert collectively in on the defensive end. But I'm going to need to see it more than a few games for me to buy into it. I think that's, unfortunately, that's where we are with this team across the board, not just Zion and BI. But I mean, yeah, it's been a nice uptick. Do you feel differently?
Yeah, no, I don't feel differently. I just want to echo your thoughts and add one thing. If Stan Van Gundy and his coaching staff are able to create this buy-in and are able to create a meaningful change in the way Brandon Ingram and Zion Williamson approach defense and their defensive mentality. You know, if there is a consistent baseline effort going forward that gets better, then Stan Van Gundy and his staff were worth every single penny.
Could not agree more. Absolutely.
Because it starts with your two stars, and we know where they're going to get it done on the offensive end. If they can not be liabilities on defense, you know, and then that's kind of the bar I'm setting. Don't be a liability, right? I'm not even asking to be like phenomenal. Don't be a liability, because if you're not liabilities, it's very easy to build a good defense around you guys. And then if you are beyond that, you know, if you are positive defenders, impactful defenders, event generators, right? You block shots, you get deflections, you get steals. That's that next level. And, you know, I feel like I'm getting ahead of myself, but, you know, I want to see them turn into a non-liabilities first. And to me, that will make Sam and Gundy pay for himself if they become non-liabilities. And if they take that next level, man, just that's really good. It's a really good indicator for the health of this franchise going forward.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I think that's, you know, if my options are miss the playoffs, but see a defensive buy-in from Zion and from Brandon Ingram that I believe in, versus making the playoffs and just doing it because you're an offensive juggernaut and not really caring much on defense, which this correlation and versus causation issues there to have those two scenarios actually be unique. But I'd still take it without a second thought. I mean, the long-term success of this team together depends on BI and Zion not being negatives together on defense. And if we can see that start to change in a meaningful way, that's the ball game for me, at least this year.
Yep. Could not agree more. On to the Rockets next. Thank you for listening to us once again. Appreciate y'all. And have a good night.
Nobody builds 5G like Verizon builds 5G, because we're the engineers who built the most reliable network in America. And the more you do with 5G, the more building it right matters. The more your network matters. The more Verizon engineers going the extra mile matters. It's us pushing us. It's Verizon versus Verizon. 5G built right from America's most reliable network. Most reliable based on rankings from RootMetrics second half 2020 U.S. report of 3 mobile networks. Results may vary. Award is not an endorsement.